Ladies and gentlemen, as Master and on behalf of the College, it's my pleasure to welcome you all to Fitzwilliam and the occasion of its annual foundation lecture. It celebrates both its original foundation in 1869 and the Royal Charter in 1966, which is when this lecture was inaugurated, granting Fitzwilliam full collegiate status. Also on your handouts, that founding history is overlaid by the partial history of this lecture since 1966, which has brought to the College men and women in all academic fields and has mostly brought back to the College all kinds of distinguished speakers who have a real link with Fitzwilliam, either as former students or as former fellows. And these range from overseas prime ministers to two out of three of our Nobel laureates to eminent scientists and economists and doctors, as I said, in every field of human endeavour. But never, in my experience, which is particularly interesting in the context of the predicted demise of the book and bookshops and even writing, if that is understood in our text messaging age, as meaning grammar, spelling, complete sentences, and the literary, all predicted to fade away soon. As I say, never in the history of this lecture have we ever had an occasion as packed as this. At which point, rather like the buffetic intervention of that strange man who comes on stage in front of the curtain at the theatre or the opera, can I interpose that when I was last at a grand occasion like this in Great St. Mary's on Sunday last, it was not helped by the sound of a ringing phone, and the lady didn't actually switch it off. She just let it kept on ringing as she tried to make her way through the crowd, and the disapproving Remembrance Day silence of that particular occasion. So I don't think I need to say anything more about mobile phones. John Mullen is no exception to being another foundation lecturer who we are welcoming back to Fitzwilliam. The handout elaborates his distinguished career as an academic and in the public domain. What it does not do is detail the fact that he had a brilliant career as a student at King's before becoming a junior research fellow at Jesus and before getting his first real job here at Fitzwilliam in 1987 as college lecturer in English. And actually that's not quite true, because, and not many people know this, there is another part of his CV in the year he spent between his BA and his PhD, and he didn't spend it on a gap year. He spent it teaching maths and English at Pentonville Prison. In fact, when he was interviewed, apparently I've forgotten this, when he was interviewed for his job here, somebody looked at his CV and said, "So what were you doing in the year that's missing from your CV?" And he said, "I was in prison." Anyway, so that was a pretty real experience, I imagine, and it makes most of us feel pretty inadequate. There are not many people who can teach English and maths, and the experience was suitably grounding, I imagine, for his 7 years as a fellow of this college, during which he was director of studies, as well as making a huge contribution to the life and work of this place, not least as tutor for undergraduate admissions. He left here for UCL in 1984, and his career, as you know, took off from there. But his resignation letter to one of my predecessors, beyond even the sincerity of John's authorship of books on sentimentalism in the 18th century novel, speaks of his relationship with Fitzwilliam in terms of his fondness and his warm memories, so he said, of the friendliness and tolerance of its fellowship. And as he wrote, "Above all, I shall miss the students, here. I have known Cambridge for a long time and have not come across another college with undergraduates as highly motivated and simply likeable. I shall miss them and hope that they continue to prosper. Now, some of those students of the 1980s and 90s are here tonight, and they have indeed prospered, and indeed one of them was a Booker Prize judge before John, and they are all, of course, I imagine, still likeable. And many others here are simply not allowed to forget John, whether as a wonderful teacher or critic or colleague or commentator or simply a presence. He's on TV, he writes on all kinds of topics in the media, and you're in the car listening to the radio and you're fiddling around with the radio looking for something interesting to listen to, and you hear that inimitable voice. That's what we're going to listen to. Could you please welcome John Mullen back to Fitzwilliam to give this year's foundation lecture at a moment when the world seems to be concerned with the fictions of business. He's going to talk to us about the business, in every sense, I imagine, of literary fiction. John.
Thanks very much, Robert. I actually had a rather ropey career at King's College, but and it's something very, something a bit spooky about that letter still existing. I can't remember actually ever writing any letter, ever, but I don't remember that one, and it's still in the files. I'm very touched and flattered to have been invited back to do this lecture, because I do indeed have very warm feelings about Fitzwilliam, about my time here, about Robert, actually, who has so magnificently spurned the ravages of time, and like nobody else I know, actually. And I do remember very well that interview. I don't remember the, I imagine, rather self-righteous stuff about being in a, having worked in a prison, but I remember the interview, I remember Robert, and I think that I have a special bond with Fitzwilliam, I have a special bond with Robert, with the master, because we have that special rapport that I think you only get when you're interviewed by somebody who's the chair of the interview panel, who then gives you the job. Because for the rest of your life, not only do you have every reason for thinking that he or she is a person of absolutely searing judgment, but he or she has every reason to want to think that you are wonderful yourself. There is, as one or two of the more senior members of this audience will know, nothing worse than realizing a year or two down the line that you got that one wrong. So bear that in mind when you hear Robert's flattering comments. He has every interest in thinking that what he said is true, because I was, as it were, his choice as left back. I have very warm feelings towards my colleagues that I had. I'm actually one or two of my former colleagues, other fellows are here this evening, who were indeed extremely tolerant of me. I need tolerance at the best of times. When I came here when I was 28, I needed a great deal of it, and I got it. And towards the students that I taught here, if I may, I'm allowed a little flourish of vanity, because it was a student, I don't know quite who it was, I think I know, but I don't think she is actually present here, so I can say without embarrassment to anybody in the audience, it was a student at Fitzwilliam who uttered the nicest thing that's ever been said to me, I think, in my life, and the nicest thing anyway ever said to me, except by my wife. And it was the evening I just found out that I was going to UCL, and it happened to be that very evening, we had a supper just for English students, just for the Fitzwilliam English students. And if you were director of studies, you got up and made a little speech about everything gone during the year. So I did this, and I also said, well, I'd only by this stage told two or three people in the college about that I was leaving. And I said to the English undergraduates, I told them the news, and I said, and at the end of this academic year, I'll be going off to UCL. And as I said it, one of the undergraduates actually went, "Oh, no!" And that's exactly how it sounded. "Oh, no!" And that is the nicest single thing that anybody outside my family has ever said, definitely. And I'll always remember that. It was admittedly at the end of supper. But I like to think that it was sentiment as well as booze. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you about the business of literary fiction. And I've got a rather austere PowerPoint display, I'm afraid. I'm sorry, a better person would have downloaded amusing images of well-known literary figures doing something foolish. I did entertain fantasies of doing that, but it hasn't come to it. But I have got some bits of novels, actually, because the business of literary fiction I'm going to talk about is partly business, partly to do with commerce and sales and the making of money, which is what drives the production of novels. But also, I want to talk about the business of fiction in a more colloquial sense of the word business, I suppose. What happens in literary fiction? What this stuff is, whether there is such a thing. I think there is such a thing. And what the reading and writing of literary fiction has entailed over the last decade or two. And those two things come together all the time, of course. They came together, I wish I had a video of it. It wasn't being filmed. If I could just show you the moment at which these little moments happen quite often, but the moment at which those two kinds of business came together for me most recently was a few months ago at the dinner for the Man Booker International Prize, which is given every 2 years to a writer from anywhere in the world. And as you might know, it was given this year to the great, well, most people would think great, American novelist Philip Roth. And at the dinner, Peter Clarke, the chief executive of the Man Group, who supply the money, stood up to make a speech. And on these occasions, it's rather peculiar because actually the representative of the Man Group, the money people, always they're the only ones who actually ever speak with any enthusiasm about literature. I mean, it's a peculiar irony. And it is actually, although it's not, I'm sure, the reason that they give the money, it is a peculiarity of the business that not just Peter Clarke, but a couple of other people who sometimes arrive at these events to represent their company, are clearly absolutely in love with the novels they're talking about, and they always speak with great idealism about the importance of literature in contemporary life. The literary types less often do that. Anyway, Peter Clarke stood up and he made his speech, and he did it very graciously, and at the end of it he said that he was pleased to announce that negotiations were very near to completion for the extension of his company's sponsorship of the Man Booker Prizes for into the medium and long term, and it was all going to be renewed and extended for many years to come. And at that point, this large room, it was in the banqueting house on Whitehall, completely full of people, almost all of whom were in publishing, or they were agents, or they were critics, or journalists. There was a roar of applause, and all the sort of slightly sceptical expressions which come on people's faces when the sponsor takes to the plinth disappeared as hands were smacked together in relish at, and relief, I suppose, at the thought that the sponsorship was going to continue. And literary fiction, I would talk a little bit about, as I've been involved in it a bit, but also because it's extremely important and influential, talk a little bit about the Man Booker Prize, because that's a way into, I think, thinking about this very close relationship, and I think often a very good relationship, actually, between some of the more interesting, sometimes even experimental writers novelists of the last few decades, and people who have liked to give quite large sums of money to the encouragement, the reading, the publication, and the valuing of these things. If you're a man Booker judge, the commercial aspect is absolutely clear right from the beginning, and clear in a rather Giles Foden, who is as Robert said, was a judge before I ever got there, will know this. I'm sure it happened to him when he was a judge too. One of the peculiar things that happens is while you're judging, you get to certain stages, you make a long list and a short list, and you choose a winner. And at the first meeting after you've chosen your long list, which is the meeting where you're going to choose your short list from the 13 on the long list, the people who are organising the whole thing give you some spreadsheets. And the spreadsheets have got sales figures on. And the spreadsheets have got the titles of all the books that were on the long list. And they have, I seem to think it was week by week sales figures, actually. Not even month by month. No, it's week by week sales figures for each of those 13 titles. And they give it to you as a sort of encouragement, I suppose. Because, of course, what you see is that the books sell very, very different. That they have very, very different sales figures. The year I was judging it, for instance, one of the writers on the long list and the short list was Sarah Waters, and her figures were double already before we put her on any list, the next person in order. But what you saw was as soon as the long list was announced, something which, in a way, you might think is not surprising, which was the figures just go, whoop! They all double or treble. And then when you meet to make the final decision, they show you the same thing happening for the shortlist. Actually, it happens more dramatically for the shortlist. Maybe they double for the longlist and then they all treble or quadruple the sales figures when people are on the shortlist. Which means, of course, something very obvious, which perhaps people aren't always very good at admitting to. I will admit to it, but I don't know if academics are generally very good at admitting to it, which is people see the book on a list and they go and buy it. Yeah? And we all sort of think, I think, in our hearts that maybe that's a sort of slightly undiscriminating response. Yeah? But of course, at heart, this is the response which the whole prize-giving culture is based on. And it seems to me an entirely reasonable response, actually. Otherwise, in that sort of territory, that unmappable territory of new fiction, those even the books they choose after much sort of joshing and semi-bribery to put on the tables in Waterstones, the ones that get to the table, even there it's impossible to choose, isn't it? And this whole thing, of course, the whole business of literary prizes is very old, but I wanted to kind of find a way into thinking about what literary fiction is in itself and looking at some examples, by thinking a bit about the history of it. And I thought one way of doing it took a couple of personalities. And one of the personalities I wanted to take, somebody I think who is very influential in both the founding of the Booker Prize, as it was originally, and actually our ideas about literary fiction and writers' ideas about what careers are possible, actually. And that's the publisher who's still alive, Tom Mashler, who used to be the chairman of Jonathan Cape, and who was, if you read his memoir, which is just called Publisher, Tom Mashler, Publisher, you would think that it was only his idea. But I mean, he was largely the driving force behind the invention of the Booker Prize, which was given for the first time in 1969, as I'm sure you all know, to P.H. Newby's Something to Answer For, the only Booker winner that has ever been out of print. I believe it's still out of print. Not a bad book, actually. And a sign of changing times. P.H. Newby wrote the book while being controller of Radio 3, or the third program as it was then, and he would sort of knock off work about 4 and go back to his home in Oxfordshire and write a bit of a novel. And he himself was amazed. He carried on, he wrote quite a lot of novels, he carried on being controller of the third program, didn't give up his day job ever, and he received £5,000 in 1969, and actually, as Mashler points out, the week after it was awarded to him, his novel appeared in the top 10 Evening Standard bestsellers. And that might may seem, it wasn't top or anything, but that seemed a sign of what could be achieved, this novelist. And he was quite a sort of, quite an arty novelist. Had managed suddenly to sell several thousand copies instead of a few hundred or even tens of copies. Now, Mashler was he had this wheeze because he approached the Booker Company, a food distribution company, they still exist, because for peculiar reasons, Booker McConnell was in the business of buying up the copyrights of popular, as an investment, purely as an investment, of commercially successful writers. And they had bought up the copyright to Ian Fleming. And Mashler had published Ian Fleming. And this gave him an in, and he suggested, sort of over golf one day, to the chairman of Booker that he might support this prize. And that's how it started. Now, it's also, Mashler's an important person because he was, as an editor, as somebody who commissioned other editors, but as a publisher of fiction, he had an extraordinary kind of stable. He was the publisher of all those famous, now 60-something men, you know, Salman Rushdie, Ian McEwan, Martin Amis, Julian Barnes. He had all four, okay? So, a full suit he had, and was very, very influential. Obviously, they were writers of great talent, but he was very, very influential in spotting them and manoeuvring their futures. And he knows that. I recommend his memoir to you. It's a very interesting read about the history of British publishing. And it's interesting partly because, I mean, he's in person a very charming man. He's in print. He's quite a... How can I put it? There are no lights going under bushels. And there's a wonderful photo in the middle of the memoir of him, a still relatively youthful Ian McEwan, both of them in south of France somewhere. And Tom Mashler's wearing a T-shirt, and it just says, "The world's greatest publisher." And I imagine he was sort of talking to his publisher about memoir, saying, "That one's got to go in." And in a way, that photograph is a kind of cameo of British literary fiction, somehow, over the last 30, 40 years. But actually, before this generation, who basically made their names in the 1980s, there were others, and I wanted to just go back a little bit further, because thinking about what literary fiction might be and where it might come from, I think it's helpful not to just think of those very well-known names. I'm going to come to them in a second. And I'll start, I think if you look at it, examples, in a way you see whether there is such a thing as literary fiction, what it might be and what its business is. But it might be a good idea just to hazard a sort of couple of loose definitions which are going to guide me. And I hope that the sort of more interesting characteristics will become apparent as I go through the lecture. But I say two modest definitions. If we think of literary fiction as novels whose readers are supposed to notice what's being done in different ways with the form of what they read, okay? So just the kind of thing that, say, Kingsley Amis would profess to hate. He always liked to say, you know, a sentence is a way of getting you from one place to another. And in literary fiction, of course, no. A sentence is something to be looked at, to be turned over. But also not just sentences, that literary fiction requires readers, expects readers who are prepared to somehow relish the form of the thing. And also, a second modest definition, that literary fiction tends to offer readers a very traditional literary pleasure, actually, which is the pleasure of allusion. So literary fiction is literary fiction often because it's full of literature. And I will have a couple of examples of what that might mean, examples you might recognise. I've got some passages up, and I haven't labelled any of them. I thought we might introduce a little bit of a quiz element. Maybe, you know, if it's flat, we'll have a quiz element. If they're not responding. But maybe you can have your own private quiz in your head as they're going through, as we're going through. What I thought we might look at first of all was a kind of pioneer career in the business of literary fiction. Because I said I want to go back a bit before the sort of the 1980s. And actually Mashler's my way into this because there was one particular literary career. I mean, there are figures one might choose who wrote very, we might think in various ways, very literary novels and sold a lot. And this is the combination I'm interested in. People who wrote in quite formally demanding ways and yet had huge commercial success. And I did think of some of the other examples. I thought in the late 50s, early 60s, Lawrence Durrell, who actually became a rich man, although he's hopeless at coping with it, with the Alexandra Quartet, which is sort of absolutely unreadable, but not because it's unreadably bad, because it's so ripe and amazingly sort of sentences stuffed full of more words and clauses than you could ever imagine. But I won't inflict that on them. I thought actually there's a career which I think is incredibly important, partly because it showed other writers what could be done, and partly actually it showed publishers what could be done. It's a writer that I would imagine most people here under the age of 40 will probably never have heard of, but anybody here over the age of 50 will probably have read. In between, not so sure. And that's career of a writer. Mashler really formed his career, made a lot of money from this man. He's called John Fowles. Now, you'll have heard of him probably because he wrote The French Lieutenant's Woman, which was made into a very anemic film. And actually, the book's more interesting and less anemic. And his career is extremely... it was a very unusual one, I think. There's some similarities between Fowles, and I want to have a look quickly at French Lieutenant's Woman now. Some similarities between Fowles and his near contemporary, a bit younger than him, 12 years or so, older than him, and that's William Golding. I mean, they were both only achieved success in middle age. They both teach school teachers, and they've both been writing lots and lots of novels. And when Mashler got sent Fowles' first novel, The Collector, which is a very creepy novel, but was a huge commercial success, he said, have you ever written any others? And Fowles says, yes, I've written 9. And Golding was a bit like that, because when Lord of the Flies was a huge success, I don't know if you look at the publication dates of Golding's novels, he produced another novel the next year, and the year after, and the year after, because he already had them all. I mean, he rewrote them and things, but he already had them. He'd got lots of novels. Fowles was a career of somebody who didn't expect to have this career. He had a great success with Collector. His next book was a book called The Magus. I don't know if you've heard of it. I mean, it must have a certain currency still, because a few years ago when the BBC had that absurd Big Read poll, I don't know if you remember, the nation's favourite novel. It's Lord of the Rings, yes. I don't know if you remember that, but The Magus got into the top 100, you know, and plenty of better novels didn't. So there obviously is a kind of residual thing. And he made lots of money. He sold even more copies in America than he did in Britain. In fact, he was so successful in America that the film rights of The Magus were sold before it was even published as a book to 20th Century Fox. He resigned his teaching job, of course. And in 1969, he published his third novel, The French Lieutenant's Woman. 1969 is a big date. The Americans got Portnoy's Complaint, and we got The French Lieutenant's Woman. The French Lieutenant's Woman, as you might know, is a book set in the 1860s, set in Lyme Regis in the 1860s, and very influential on a certain vein, a certain strain of later literary historical fiction, Possession, The Crimson Petal and The White, lots of other sort of Victoriana novels, literary Victoriana novels. But unlike many of them, The French Lieutenant's Woman made an extraordinary sort of play of the fact that it was not written in the language or with the mindset of the characters that it described. It's a third-person narrative, and the third person who narrates is the person who narrates is quite clearly John Fowles. And John Fowles was much preoccupied with French. He was a Francophile and a Francophone, and he thought that the English were a very sort of intellectually poor and literary impoverished lot. And he read the Nouveau Roman, and he thought he would introduce lots of kind of clever things from France, which the English had not heard of. And here is, I should have quizzed you on what this is from, right. Okay. And here's a typical little passage from The French Lieutenant's Woman. And The French Lieutenant's Woman is just introduced as the character of a woman, a fallen woman, mysterious fallen woman called Sarah Woodruff. And he says, the narrative, as it were, says at the end of chapter 12, what is her mystery? Who is Sarah? End of chapter. And then the next chapter begins with the narrator saying, well, I don't know. If I've pretended until now to know my character's minds and innermost thoughts, it is because I'm writing in, just as I've assumed some of the vocabulary and voice of, a convention and universally accepted at the time of my story, that the novelist stands next to God. He may not know all, yet he tries to pretend he does. But I live in the age of Alain Robbe Grillet and Roland Barthes. And it's absolutely sort of characteristic of him. He makes a kind of virtue, or he offers as a kind of virtue, the anachronistic jarring of his knowledge and his sophistication and the characters whom he keeps saying are invented, they're just pawns, he doesn't really know about them, it's all an illusion. And actually, it's a very interesting book to read because it's all an illusion, and then he goes back to the story, and as soon as the story starts again, however much you've been told it's an illusion, you're right back into it. It's a cracking story. I think he sort of knows that, although this sort of this kind of bluff, faux, sort of exasperated authorial comment is a bit of a bluff, I think. You get extraordinary effects out of what I've called this jarring. Now, in books, in what academic books about the history of fiction, he's often cited as the sort of first postmodern British novelist, because the word idea didn't exist. People didn't know there was such a thing in those days. But you can see, I mean, this was a kind of weird and unprecedented thing to be doing in a novel. You get these extraordinary... I just wanted to pluck one sort of absolutely characteristic sentence. Now, this is also from The French Lieutenant's Woman. And a couple of absolutely... What's happening? This is, you need to know just briefly, this is a really charged scene. It's in a sort of Lyme Regis drawing room in sort of 1867. And the male protagonist, Charles Smithson, who is a sort of moneyed amateur paleontologist, is there with his fiancée, Ernestina. And they're in the drawing room of this austere, pious woman called Mrs. Pulteney. And Mrs. Pulteney has taken on Sarah Woodruff as a kind of good cause, but also sort of to moralise her, to punish her in a way. So Sarah's sort of suspended between being a companion and a servant, not quite sure of her status. And on this occasion, they encounter this kindly lady called Mrs. Tranter, who is not, although she is sort of a straight-laced elderly lady, she is not so moralistic, and she speaks kindly to Sarah. Most of the time, nobody speaks to Sarah, and certainly not kindly. And you get this. For a second then, a rare look crossed Sarah's face. That computer in her heart had long before assessed Mrs. Tranter and stored the resultant tape. All right? This isn't the... I mean, there's lots and lots like this. Stuff about jet planes and telephones and... They didn't have television. He actually says that quite a few times about the characters. You must imagine what they're doing in the evening. They didn't have television. But you can see there's a wonderful sort of double effect for us, isn't it? Because this is 1969. Computers were things in huge rooms, weren't they? With lots of kind of reels of tape going round. You can see some. It's kind of two sort of... It's a bit like the sort of geology that Charles, the character, sort of studies. There's sort of two layers of history here. There's the layer, as Foles thinks, of distant Victorian mores, but he's put in his own jarring, you're alerted to the fact it's fiction, present-day metaphor, but that's become history too. In a way that I didn't notice when I first read this novel a long, long time ago, when rereading it, you notice this all the time, and it's actually quite unsettling. But it didn't unsettle the fortunes of the book. It was a huge bestseller in Britain and in the States, long before it became a film. It's actually, because of various accidents, took a long time for it to reach the screen. And Foles was the most commercially successful, I would say, literary novelist. Well, again, people didn't really use that phrase either, of the age. Of the late 60s and of the 70s. He regularly received six-figure sales in the United States. His later novel, Daniel Martin, he got $500,000 advance for it in America. You know, that's in the 1970s, serious money. Mashler, it's quite good because, of course, Foles, like lots of people, like Lawrence Durrell, made lots of money. He's mean as anything. And absolutely... sort of obsessed with not spending too much money. And Mashler complains in his memoir that when he went to stay in his beautiful house in Lyme Regis, Belmont House, which is actually in the film, when he went to stay with him, which Mashler often did, you had to have your bath between 5 and 7 in the evening because that was the only time that the hot water was turned on, even though Foles at the time was one of the most highly paid writers in the English-speaking world. This is what happens. It's kind of God's justice, really. The next date, so this kind of I think Foles sets a new sort of pioneering route because these peculiar, experimental-looking novels of his with lots of allusions, quotations, French Lieutenant's Woman, you've read it, you'll know, it's absolutely full of tons of quotations from Victorian literature, from Karl Marx, from 19th century writing, and footnotes. He writes footnotes to his own story. Oh, by the way, you'll see here, da-da-da-da-da. And it was a novel very unlike the middle market fiction in the late 1960s, and it was a huge success. And I think that sort of was, in a way, the route into a phenomenon which we're familiar with from the 1980s. And I guess the key date there is not a very surprising one, really. 1981, when Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children won the Booker Prize. I think the Booker had begun to acquire a bit of notoriety the year before. There was a great face-off in 1980 between, literary face-offs are fantastic, I think, between William Golding and Anthony Burgess. You know, it's Ali and Frazier. It's fantastic. Anthony Burgess said he was on the shortlist with Earthly Powers, and he said he would come to the ceremony in the Guildhall, provided he knew in advance that he'd won. And when they declined to give him this reassurance, he declared an alternative Booker party in the Savoy Hotel. And he didn't get it. William Golding got it with Rites of Passage. But it created quite a lot of waves. And the next time, 1981, it's televised. The televisation of the Booker, it doesn't happen anymore. It used to be wonderful. and relishable. And relishable because in the 1980s, a sort of innocent times, really, the media and fiction weren't kind of used to each other that much. I mean, the novel was becoming news, and we're used to that now. It's something, you know, there's a new Ian McEwan novel, there'll be something on the Today programme about what it's about, as if the publication is some important public event. But this didn't happen in the early 80s, and there was sort of wonderful sort of clumsiness. You all remember the great 1983 is the prize year. Selina Scott. It's not on YouTube, sadly. Otherwise, I might have had a really good go at uploading it. Selina Scott was covering it for the BBC, and she was waltzing around. She was quite sort of sinuous, and she waltzed around with a microphone, and she went up to one sort of slightly sort of swotty-looking lady at a table nearby, and she said, have you read the winning book? And the swotty-looking lady said, well, yes, I have, because and she said, and then she said, and what is your name? She said, my name's Angela Carter. And then, even more brilliantly, afterwards, she interviewed Faye Weldon, who was chair of the judges, and Faye Weldon saying, marvellous shortlist. And Selina Scott said, yes, the shortlist, 6 books. Did you get to the end of all of them? But anyway, things are a bit slicker nowadays, but we don't, unfortunately, have quite the same sort of match of the day experience that we used to have. And, I mean, the early 80s are when it seemed to be happening, not just the fact that Midnight's Children, by an author nobody'd ever heard of, it wasn't his first book, and it was pulled out of nowhere, and it became immensely popular, and also it seemed to be a kind of new kind of voice, and indeed, it sort of was, because Rushdie had got what he was doing, and he had his own voice, but he'd also got what he's doing from all these fancy European things, like Gunter Grass's The Tin Drum and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and it was all quite sort of intoxicating. And when you started getting things, these other kind of lists, like Granta published a very, notorious, in 1983, list of the best young British novelists, and the issue of Granta, I remember that year, I was a graduate student then, came out with a sort of exploding pen, exploding kind of Union Jack pen on the front cover. And yes, gosh, politics is awful, but the novel, that's where it's happening. And the very first thing in it was this. Which some of you, I don't know, will recognise. I'm not quite sure what accent to read it in, but as my cab pulled off FDR Drive, somewhere in the early hundreds, a low-slung tomahawk full of black guys came sharking out of a lane and sloped in fast right across our bows. We banked and hit a deep welt or grapple ridge in the road. To the sound of a rifle shot, the cab roof ducked down and smacked me on the core of my head. I really didn't need that, I tell you, with my head and face and back and heart hurting a lot all the time anyway, and still drunk and crazed and ghosted from the plane. It's the opening, although the book hadn't been published then, it was a work in progress, of Martin Amis's 1984 novel Money. Cracking, I just think it's fantastic. Hotel du Lac won the Booker Prize that year. Two kind of cultures, really, and it was one of those years where some people on the panel did say, over my dead body. But whatever you think about what's happened to Martin Amis's writing there, at the time, I still think it's pretty good. And it goes on like this for quite a long time, with lots of very funny things and lots of pratfalls, not much of a story, but great stuff. And that's the word Martin Amis introduced, by the way. There's lots of words he introduced, which I hear everybody using. Stuff was the word he introduced for writing. So I once heard him say to somebody, he's got quite a sort of drawly voice, really, but I once heard him say to a younger writer who was incredibly chuffed to hear it, I've read your stuff. That's good, isn't it? You go home happy after that, don't you? I've read your stuff. Have a bit of my stuff. And I just thought this stuff was fantastic at the time, I remember. And of course, well, you could do... I'm sure all my former students here could do a rapid practical criticism on it very, very easily. But isn't it great? It's kind of difficult accent to do, because it's sort of one of the things about it. If Salman Rushdie gives you India and a bit of South America and even a touch of Germany, this is kind of America, isn't it? But the great thing is, this kind of weird yob who narrates the story is also full of London talk. And the two kind of merge in this extraordinary kind of half illiterate and half amazingly inventive narrative voice. And it whacks you on the head, or it whacked a lot of people on the head then, and didn't get any prizes. But it did seem to tell you that, yes, fiction, that's where it's happening. British fiction, it's where it's happening. And the Booker Prize was part of that, helped it and lived off it as well, and often got things wrong. And sometimes I think, it's an interesting thing, whether it matters whether they make the right choices or not. At some stages during the 80s, it didn't actually seem to matter that much whether the Booker judges were choosing the right thing or not. It didn't matter when they chose the Bone people, actually. It didn't really stop the whole carousel going round. Whereas sometimes, more recently, it has seemed to matter a bit whether they choose the right thing or the wrong thing. They didn't choose this. But these lists and these prizes and things started being really important. And important also because they told you that something was happening. I mean, Ian Jack, who became editor of Grant and was responsible for another list of best young British novelists in 2003, I asked him about it, about what do you think about all these prizes and lists. And he said, I wrote it down as he said it, literary novels really depend on prizes and they depend on lists. And he was sort of unashamed about being in the business of helping make those. We all need maps. We all need guidance. There's so much stuff out there. There's no doubt, of course, how significant an effect on a writer's fortune some of these prizes can be. I looked around for some figures. I'll give you just to... my friend Giles Foden was worried that this talk would all be literary criticism and there'd be no money in it. And that business is a bit of a cheat, but I'm going to give you some money now, some numbers. I thought that a good comparison, last year, Howard Jacobson won the Man Booker with the Finkler question. So I looked at the figures for that. This year, Julian Barnes' novel, Sense of an Ending, I think, we don't know that much yet, but for Howard Jacobson, a long-established novelist, journalist and sort of all-round character, his previous novel, before the Finkler question, The Act of Love, sold 1,800 copies in hardback and 4,000 copies in paperback. This is in the UK. The publisher received a total revenue of £57,000 for that. The Finkler question, so far, has sold 88,000 copies in hardback and 182,000 in paperback, and the publisher has received £2.4 million. Kind of different. Yeah? You can imagine the little skip that a publisher might give when the news of a win comes in. Of course, a topic for a separate lecture, there are novelists who sustain their product, as it were, and there are those who don't. Interestingly, I looked at some figures. Midnight's Children, I don't know how many worldwide total sales for that are. I'm sure they're astronomical. But in Britain, Midnight's Children still solidly sells over 10,000 copies a year, every year. Yeah? Salman doesn't have to do anything anymore about that novel. That's gone. He has to write the next one, but that one is ticking away. And it's sort of, that seems kind of unstoppable. If you look at easiest place to get some of these figures, Nielsen BookScan, which is a subscription database. One of the things that is extraordinary is how few copies certain very, very, well, I can't say certain, but if you have access to it, anybody can find out, and the novelists and their publishers certainly know, how very few copies some incredibly well-known novelists, including some who have won the Booker Prize in the past, might now sell for the latest novel. So it's not all sort of like John Fowles. It doesn't go on forever, necessarily, at all. There are plenty of surprisingly low figures. Now, I said that when novels, I'll come to that, the payoff bit, I said when novels are talked about on the news, that this is itself a rather novel thing. This didn't used to happen. When I was a kind of rather sort of grumpy and affected undergraduate with illusions about my own abilities as a writer, grumpy and affected young men wanted to be playwrights. Yeah, odd to think of that now. The whole novelist shtick didn't really allure us. But it does now, and novels are talked about. And in the last bit of my lecture, what I wanted to sort of think about in terms of the business of literary fiction was the difference, I think, a lot of the time between the way, the no longer Selina Scottish way, that literary fiction is talked about and what it's actually like. Because the striking thing, it seems to me, is that almost whenever on radio or television or even in the newspapers, literary fiction is talked about, it's always in terms of what it is. I mean, the leading literary novelist in Britain, the one who sells the most and perhaps the best known, is Ian McEwan. And whenever a novel by him is brought out, it's always, oh, he's written this novel, it's all about the Iraq War. Oh, he's written this novel, it's all about global warming. How interesting. Can we get him on to talk about global warming or the Iraq War? And I think the one thing about that you can see about literary fiction is that characterises is it's nothing to do with what it's about. I don't think. And let's take Cielo. Oh yeah. How do we read this? Goodness knows. I don't know if you recognise this. Old George's Path. It'll go Mama Set, I'm afraid. I have no. It's supposed to be. I'll explain. This is a difficult accent to do because it's somebody who've never actually existed. Old George's path and mine cross more times than I'm comfy memorin. And after I'm died, no saying what the fangy devil won't try and do to me. So give me some mutton and I'll tell you about our first meeting. A fat juicem slice. Nay, none of your burnt wafery offerings. Do you recognise this, anybody? Impress me. Sorry? Yeah, very good. Yes, David Mitchell. What's the name of the book? Cloud Atlas. It's from the central section of David Mitchell's novel, Cloud Atlas. And David Mitchell achieved what was then the double whammy of Man Booker shortlist and Richard and Judy Book Club Book of the Year. But Richard and Judy Book Club is sort of gone, or they're off on some channel nobody ever watches anymore. They're very, very powerful for a while. Two books have received that double imprimatur. The other one, interesting, is Zoe Heller's Notes on a Scandal. Also quite a literary novel in its way. But David Mitchell, Cloud Atlas, was actually Richard and Judy's favourite pick of the whole year. And also a great popular success in the early part of this, about when did it come out, about 7 years ago, there was a time when everybody on the tube train seemed to be reading it. And if you don't know, it's an extraordinary thing for a bestseller, which is that it has a narrative structure which Mitchell calls a Russian doll. So it's got, I'm going to try and explain this, it's got six narratives written in six different genres, set in six different times, but inside each other, nested inside each other. So you start narrative A, and then that's interrupted by narrative B, which is interrupted by C, D, E, F. This is F, the latest in chronological time. I've just read you an extract from it. Then you get the whole of narrative F, and then you start working back. E, D, C, B, A. I don't know if that makes sense. Time is short, so I won't display. Used to be sort of, it's quite a demanding party piece to actually describe what each one of the stories is, where it's set, and how it differs from the next one. And also, all the narratives are connected, but in sort of slightly trivial ways. So, narrative B, set in the 1930s, a very camp British musicologist discovers in the library of a very irascible British composer living in Belgium the manuscript of the travel narrative A, written by an American who was travelling in the South Seas in the 1850s. You see what I mean? It's quite, you know, I won't kill you by going through the whole thing. I used to be able to do it. I'm not sure I can anymore. But so this, and this extraordinary narrative structure, Mitchell, who is absolutely, I have to say, unlike most novelists, amazingly, absolutely charming and candid about his methods. Somebody said to him, where did you get the idea for doing this incredible, so original? He said, oh, he said, I did a modern European literature MA at the University of Kent. And we studied Italo Calvino. And that was a bit like this. And I just thought, what a good idea. And actually, that's one of the themes I would have actually liked to explore more, the weird amount of academic input to literary fiction. Because by a peculiar irony, I think, during the 1980s, when in the humanities, certainly in my subject in English, most sort of ambitious or well-known academic critics were trying as much as possible to make what they wrote entirely unintelligible to anybody except a kind of priesthood. It's just F.R. Leavis all over again, by other means, à mon avis. But anyway, just when academic criticism seemed to be going further and further away from, as it were, the general reader, the academics were having their revenge because they'd sent in the shock troops, yes, the novelists. And because over and over again, what you notice about leading literary novelists is that they did English degrees. Many of them, I could go through a sort of list of names, did PhDs or even became academics. And although everybody talks and thinks about the influence of creative writing, creative writing courses on literary fiction, people very rarely think about the much more important to date influence of academia, actually, and of academic training and academic literary criticism on literary fiction. Everybody knows that Ian McEwan and Kazuo Shiguro did the creative writing MA at University of East Anglia, and what a fantastic, irresistible advertisement that is. But they both did English degrees first, actually, or partly English degrees. Ian McEwan at the University of Sussex, and Kazuo Shiguro at the University of Kent, which rather specialises, actually, in turning out literary novelists. It's where Sarah Waters went for a while as well. I think this is an incredibly powerful sort of formation, a formation of the writers and sometimes the readers as well. We must look at a couple of other examples before we end. You'll recognise this, do you? Yeah? This is from Ian McEwan's Atonement. And this is Brian Italis. It's a third-person narrative, but mostly, not entirely, but a lot of it from her point of view. And she's done a terrible thing. She has said that she saw her sister's, Cecilia's lover, Robbie, rape her cousin, Lola. And she didn't. She didn't see it. But she makes up things. She thinks she sees things. She loves fiction. And she sort of convinced herself, because she thinks Robbie's a bad person for various reasons. She read a very, very rude word that he wrote in a note. And he found her having sex with her sister in the library. You know what libraries are like. And that's enough to convince her he's a kind of monster. And so she testifies against him, and he's convicted. He's sent to prison, but he's let out of prison because it's the war, and he's sent off, and he fights ineffectually in the British Army in France and Belgium. And then he's caught up in the retreat to Dunkirk. He gets out, and Bryony, who to do a kind of penance is working as the lowest of the low as a nurse at St. Thomas's Hospital, even though she's a rich, posh girl, goes down to Balham, which I think for Ian McEwan is as far as you can go. She goes down to Balham to see Cecilia and Robbie, where they are shacked up, as my mother would have said, shacked up together. And she says to them, I know what I did was wrong, and I know that it wasn't true, and I'm going to make it up for you, I'm going to get you exonerated, I'm going to write all these letters to the lawyers and tell them all about it. And at the end of this section, this bit of the story. They take her to Balham Tube Station, and she stands at the top of the escalator, and we have this. She knew what was required of her, not simply a letter, but a new draft, an atonement, and she was ready to begin. BT London 1999. And I remember when I first read this, I thought, British Telecom? What's this? What's going on? Because this is one of those things, isn't it? Atonement. Oh, it's the title. Oh, I've got to the end. You know those stories which you know you've got to the end because you've got to the title. As if we were looking into the heart of an immense darkness. Oh, right, okay. We're finished. I got it. Yeah? You might like to make a mental collection of novels which end with the title. There's quite a few. And it's as if I were walking into the sea. What's that novel? Beloved. They live in Lexington, where they are accepted as just another couple. Any of you have read Couples? And if you haven't, you should. The trouble is, when you get to this bit, not only do you have this kind of puzzling thing, BT, but there's a great wadge of paper still left. And you think, oh, God, is this a list of recommendations? And that BT, and you start, and there's more. It's not the end. And obviously the physical experience of reading a novel is very important. And McEwan's using this funny thing. Here, you've got to get some Jane Austen in before the end of anything, haven't you? And you'll recognise all of this, all of you, as beginning of the last chapter in Northanger Abbey. Henry and Catherine, they can't get married because General Tilney, who's an awful person, isn't going to approve of it. How are they going to get around it? The anxiety, which in this state of their attachment, must be the portion of Henry and Catherine, and of all who loved either, as to its final event, can hardly extend, I fear, to the bosom of my readers, who will see in the telltale compression of the pages before them that we are all hastening together to perfect felicity. Postmodern or what? Perfect, isn't it? And you do have, in the modern edition, just one page left. In the original edition, you've got a couple of pages left. You know that you and they have got to get to perfect felicity very, very soon, and she's reassuring you that she's going to manage to do that. The point, of course, about the McEwan passage is that BT, remember, is not a sponsor's mark. That BT are the initials, of course, of Bryony Tallis. And it's a trick. It's a really good trick, actually, because in my experience, I've read it 3 or 4 times, I think, Atonement. And it works every time, even though you know it's going to happen. Because at that point, you realise, oh, the novel. I'm spoiling it, sorry, but it doesn't matter. You're all intellectuals, I can see. You don't mind that. And the film, that pathetic film, I thought, tried to catch the effect by having Vanessa Redgrave as an older version of the character. But BT, Bryony Tallis, because the novel you've been reading isn't written by Ian McEwan. Oh, no. No. And all its funny little tricks and chronological slippages and little bits of prediction of what's going to happen, which seem rather clumsy, are there because it's written by Bryony Tallis, of course. Because, of course, Robbie and Cecilia didn't meet up again. Robbie died, septicemia, on the beach at Dunkirk. Cecilia, there was a reason for Balham. In the tube station, Nazi bombs, the water mains burst, everybody was drowned. And the novel is the atonement, isn't it? Because she makes up, Bryony, for what she did by making it right in fiction. Makes it right in fiction. And the atonement has nothing to do with a lawyer's letter. The atonement is what you've just read. And it's clever. It's very clever. And it's the kind of trick which you perhaps expect from Ian McEwan. And it's the kind of trick which readers have come, it seems, to relish. I had some other tricks. I'm not going to give you that one. Here's another, before we end, final little kind of trick. 2 opening sentences. One may as well begin with Jerome's emails to his father. First sentence of Zadie Smith's novel On Beauty. One may as well begin with Helen's letters to her sister. The opening sentence, of course, of Ian Forster's 1910 novel, Howard's End. On Beauty is a close imitation in various ways of Howards End, and is much more fun to read if you've read Howards End, because you know what's going to happen. And it's hilarious, because the characters in it think that they're free to choose. And they're all academics. They're blithering idiots. They think they're free to choose, and they're really liberal, and they're making their own futures, but they're not. They're following an E.M. Forster plot. It's already all set out. You know exactly what's going to happen. It's a real laugh. Sometimes, you know, you can say to first-year students, why is the opening of Zadie Smith's novel not plagiarism? Some of them can't answer that one. Because I wanted just to quickly look at it, because, of course, one of the literary effects of this filling of novels with literary allusions is that plagiarism, as you might have noticed, is the sort of ghost at the feast of British literary fiction. It's amazing how many plagiarism accusations come up. Ian McEwan is kind of constantly in hiding from them, isn't he? There's an even more sort of difficult one with a Booker Prize-winning novel, Graham Swift's Last Orders, which was accused of being ripped off from William Faulkner's As I Lay Dying. And embarrassingly, the Booker judges from that year, they didn't have an academic on the panel. They always get into trouble when they don't have an academic on the panel. Academics do have their uses. Whatever their judgment, they've read books sometimes. And they didn't have an academic on the panel. And they all said, oh, yeah, no, I've never read As I Lay Dying. I didn't know that it's all the same thing. And A.N. Wilson, who was one of the judges that year, said in print, oh, I would never have voted for it if I'd known. And poor Graham Swift had to come out and say it was an homage. And of course, as one or two people pointed out, if there'd been a quote, just a little quote from William Faulkner, an epigraph just inside the title page, nobody would have said anything, would they? Because an advertised relationship is something very, very different. I think I might stop there with the enticing examples. I have some more up my sleeve. But perhaps I'm going to answer some questions if you want. You might suggest your own examples. But I hope I've done enough to say for the end of it that a kind of riposte, I suppose, to one of my enemies. I've never met him, and I hear he's really nice. David Hare. But whenever he says anything, I always disagree with it. You know, those people are very, very important in your life. You don't ever want to meet them because they're often charming. But whenever they say anything, you think, no, the opposite. And David Hare's always filled that function for me. And I can absolutely rely on him. And he was, in a discussion of literary fiction in a newspaper, he said this: the two most depressing words in the English language are literary fiction. You know, why not political drama? But I think he sort of thinks there that he's tapping into something people often think or say or argue, which is that the whole idea of literary fiction is a bit of an imposture. There's only good and bad fiction, isn't there, people say. But this is surely not true, actually. There is this identifiable thing which hasn't always been there, may not always be there in the future. Sometimes it's for good and sometimes it's not for good, but it is there, and there are these novels, I think. Atonement's one. One of my favourite novels of recent years, Sarah Waters's The Little Stranger, is another, where the whole pleasure of reading it is the narrative trickery. It's not about life and death and love and deep meanings at all, actually. It's about the sheer pleasure of the narrative ingenuity of it all, which is more and more pleasurable each time you read it, I think. And that pleasure, that formal pleasure of narrative, and this is, I suppose, my riposte to dear, convenient David Hare, is that they rely on tricks and surprises, and that these novels have such a big readership, do such good business sometimes, because there are readers there, literary readers, actually, who relish the tricks and surprises, and that the business of literary fiction is really animated by all its literary readers, and maybe there's some of them in this room. Thank you.